Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scarsbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be shining the spotlight on Pope Benedict XVI's weekend visit to Aquileia and Venice, joining a professor of Roman archaeology who gives us a tour of Aquileia, and sharing with the president and founder of the Pave the Way Foundation, Gary Krupp, an emotional 2005 audience with Pope John Paul II, now blessed. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. On Saturday, 7th of May, Pope Benedict XVI begins a weekend visit to northeastern Italy, which takes him both to Aquileia, once one of the largest cities in the Roman Empire, and to Venice, a place which I'm sure you've heard of, given it's inspired so many great travellers and writers down the centuries. Chris Altieri will be reporting for us on this apostolic visit. Stay tuned and find out more about this very brief weekend trip.
He's going to be attending a couple of meetings that are ecclesial meetings.
Beginning in Aquileia. Right?
Beginning in Aquileia, that's right. There is the assembly of the second meeting of Aquileia, the first that took place in the 90s, and he's going to be addressing the participants in this meeting. Aquileia is an important church as well. It's the mother church of several other very important churches in the whole region of Mitteleuropa.
Austria. Slovenia.
Austria, Slovenia, Croatia, some parts of what was traditionally considered also the German area of culture and civilization. And what he's going to be doing there is listening and talking and, strengthening the brethren. These are churches that are dealing with a lot of the same issues that churches, especially in the United States, are dealing with. The specifics are obviously different and very local, but they're dealing with how to manage the challenges that are posed by changing social and cultural demographics, the arrivals of new people who come from different cultural extractions. It's also a region that across political borders shares because of this, in large measure, because of this sense of ecclesial family, a very strong identity. And the church in the region has a lively sense of its own traditions and roots. And so they're looking at how to preserve that and how to integrate it with the changing cultural and social demographics. They're dealing with problems like secularization, which, interestingly enough, is a concept itself of Christian invention. Okay, the seculum is an idea that St. Augustine develops in the history of the whole Western civilizational project. And it is this space in which the temporal and the spiritual spheres exist. You could argue, actually, that the whole history of Western civilization is the history of ironing out and hashing out the details of this basic implant. So it is also, in very many important ways, I would say, a city that is history's city, where you can see the history of civilization in a nutshell unfolding. And we are witnessing one of the moments in that unfolding and that development. So it is actually exciting, even though perhaps many of the issues in the specifics that they're going to be dealing with are very local.
Okay. He doesn't stay there very long. He doesn't stay in Aquileia very long. He moves on to Venice that same evening.
He moves on to Venice that same evening.
Everybody knows about Venice. But why is he going there?
Well, he's going there because Cardinal Scola, Patriarch of Venice, has invited him to go. He's going to participate in the conclusion of the ecclesial assembly, Cardinal Scola's diocesan pastoral visit. It's been going on for several years now, and it's wrapping up. And the Holy Father is going there to participate in this assembly that's bringing this process to a close. Again, this is broadly fitting into his mandate to strengthen the brethren.
Everybody knows where Venice is, and everybody knows the Basilica of St. Mark. But while the Holy Father is going to visit this stunning basilica. He's going to preside over Holy Mass elsewhere, no, owing to the numbers that are expected to attend.
The number of people who are interested in seeing the Holy Father when he goes there, they simply wouldn't fit. There are logistical reasons for which he's not actually going to be celebrating at St. Mark's. He is, though, celebrating Mass on Sunday morning at the San Giuliano Park in Mestre, which is hard by the island city of Venice. People will be looking forward to his homily on that occasion. It is a gathering, a liturgical event that will actually bring together people not just from the Archdiocese of Venice or from the Diocese of Venice, but from the whole ecclesial province, all of the
and from Aquileia
and from Aquileia as well, who were invited. Yes, he's doing some other interesting things in and around Venice. He has in the evening a meeting with the world of culture and economy, meaning artists, people involved in various and sundry aspects of what we might call even show business, part
of culture
and something, the world of culture. And they say economy in Italian, we would say commerce, industry, etc., more closely in English. The Holy Father is at pains always to make it very clear that the Church is and needs to be aware of itself and to present itself as an integral partner in this civilizational conversation, in this cultural dialogue.
I believe he's going to get into a gondola at some point, no?
That is on the schedule, yes. He's going to, the gondola is, of course, the usually black lacquered wooden skiff. The pilot stands in the back and pilots with a
stripy shirt.
Yes, a boater cap, right?
Boater.
And, well, yeah, there you have it. It's one of the nods to the culture and to the tradition of the city. Yeah.
Well, thanks very much, Chris. And my thanks there go to Chris Altieri. Don't miss his reports on Pope Benedict's visit to Aquileia and Venice this coming weekend. I'd like to turn my attention to Aquileia, perhaps not so well known as Venice. Aquileia is on the River Aquila and is perhaps one of Italy's most hidden treasures, not just because of what you can see there, but also because of what you can't see. That's kind of an odd statement. I'll better explain. Founded in 181 BC as a strategic Roman fortress city built to defend boundaries on the one hand from the barbarians that came from the east, and on the other, the so-called Amber Road, which connected the Transalpine world with the sea. The reason there's still a lot you can't see here is because in this place, most of what was here is so extended that much of it has not yet been excavated. Just think, in Roman times, there was a forum, a circus, a theatre, and of course an amphitheatre. Not all is visible. What is in sight is the stone from the amphitheatre, which many centuries later the local inhabitants pilfered to build the bell tower of the ancient basilica that still stands there and that beckons from afar as you approach this site and its romantic ruins scattered around its cypress-lined lanes. Clearly, it's expensive to excavate an area as large as this. It's a place where some scholars argue that up to 500,000 people once lived, in what was one of the largest cities in Italy after Rome, and indeed one of the largest in the Roman Empire. I recently met someone who goes there often. She's Professor Catherine McDonnell, and she teaches Roman archaeology at the University of California, Los Angeles, with a particular expertise in the Roman Empire. What led her to Aquileia was her search for Roman inscriptions. This is the place in the world where there is the largest corpus of Roman inscriptions after Rome and Ostia. I invited her to sit down with me in our studios here and began by asking her where these inscriptions are housed.
Most of the inscriptions are in one of the museums in Aquileia. So there's the National Archaeological Museum, which has the Roman material, and then there's the Paleo-Christian or Early Christian Museum, which has the Christian material. And both are filled with inscriptions partially because they were collected at a time in the 18th and 19th century when people normally collected inscriptions and then placed them in museums.
What do they tell us about the Romans?
Most of them are funerary. That's true for any site in the Roman Empire. But we have a few from Aquileia that talk about the early settlement or that are religious dedications or that mark important events in the history of the city, such as the revolt of Aquileia against Maximinus Thrax. Different things. They tell me to a certain extent what family relationships were like, who commemorates whom, who builds a tomb for whom. They use a lot of adjectives to describe each other. So dearest daughter, devoted father, things that are very familiar to us from cemeteries today. And then I also use them to look at the ways in which people constructed their own identity. Roman cemeteries were just outside the city, so you walked through them coming in and out of town. So they were also a way in which you could advertise yourself, advertise your family, because the Romans built tombs about a third of the time for themselves while they were still alive. These are practices that to us seem a little odd, because at least the United States, we're so removed from thinking about the dead, except when someone dies. But for the Romans, there was a much more constant interaction with tombs. It's impossible, really, when you go there now to realize how large a city it was. Because now it's a small provincial town, lovely place to visit, easy to get around. A sleepy place, yeah. But it's as if, you know, as if Rome itself lay underneath a sleepy provincial town. And the resources and the time to excavate it comes intermittently.
So what about the basilica itself? The crypt within and the stunning mosaic floors dating back to early Christianity, late Roman times.
The basilica that we see now was built by Bishop Popo in the Ottonian era. Beneath it is a church, isn't quite the right word, but a Christian complex that dates to the 4th century AD, in fact, not long after Constantine becomes emperor in Rome. And it has mosaic floors that date back to that period, 4th century, that were excavated just before the First World War. Both of them have sort of geometric patterns. The one side, the geometric patterns are filled with animals, and there's been a lot of discussion as to whether or not there's direct Christian symbolism there, a question I think the Pope could probably answer better than I could. On the other side, there's a lovely depiction of the story of Jonah, from getting eaten by the whale to eventually his return under the fig tree. The whole narrative is laid out. And there's also images of the Good Shepherd and some donor portraits, people who paid for the mosaic, and an inscription that records its commissioning by the man who was bishop in the 4th century, a man named Theodore.
Well, believe it or not, inscriptions pitched up again in the conversation, so naturally I asked what their content was.
It says roughly that Theodore paid for this building and decoration to be made. It's fairly straightforward. But he says it twice. There's two different areas, and he refers to the beauty of what he created, too.
But these mosaics are in the basilica itself.
Yes. I think at that point, Aquileia was still under the Austrians, and they became interested in what was beneath the church and excavated it. So now what you see when you go in is they've put down a glass floor and walkway, and you walk along that, and you're looking at the 4th century floors. They don't directly correspond to the later church, but they correspond well enough that you can get a good view of most of the mosaics from the 4th century building.
Despite having been to Aquileia twice myself over the years, I was getting confused as to the different levels of the basilica. So I pressed Catherine for better explanation.
There's a church crypt, a crypt with relics, etc., which is under the front of the Ottonian church. And then there's something which they also call the crypt, which is these two rooms of the Christian complex, one which lies directly under the basilica, and then one which actually lies underneath the ground outside and underneath the bell tower. So when you're down looking at the mosaics, in one part you're actually underneath the campanile. You're actually down in this, what I would call a crypt area there. In the other area, you're under the church, and then the front of the church, just as in St. Peter's, there's a crypt with relics and frescoes.
Of course, one of the legendary things about Aquileia, one no longer visible, was the presence there of a mint. No ordinary mint, it seems.
Yes, it was set up by Diocletian. When he revises the provinces of the empire, so he divides up administration, he establishes a mint at Aquileia then, and it becomes one of the major mints for the Western Empire.
At this point, I was tempted to ask my archaeologist if she could fill me in more specifically on the Christian side of things regarding the basilica.
Aquileia was famous in Roman times for always taking the side of the rightful emperor. So when it came down to the battle between Constantine and Maxentius, they picked Maxentius' side, since legally he had been appointed the emperor of Italy and Constantine had been appointed the emperor of the northwestern provinces. So they take the wrong side, as it turns out. But Constantine doesn't punish the city for it. And eventually he passes through it, and the city is honored in various ways, and they honor him, of course, in various ways. Then it's important because the sons of Constantine, of course, since there are three of them, can never agree on who's in charge of what. And Constantine II and Constans actually battle for supremacy near Aquileia, which Constans wins. And actually it's at Aquileia when Julian the Apostate learns that Constantius has died and that he is now emperor. So there's quite a lot, actually, of 4th century history especially that happens right around that period. And of course it remains militarily important because it's one of the junctures between the East and West, both geographically and by sea.
Clearly, Aquileia takes on a central role then in the spread of Christianity.
Yeah, it does. And Aquileia plays an interesting role in what I would call the early medieval church. They split from Rome in the 7th century. There's a dispute. And they set up their own religious authority. They start to call themselves the patriarchs, as opposed to, say, the Pope in Rome or the Patriarch in Constantinople. So very independent bishop princes. And even after they reconciliate with Rome, they keep the title of patriarch, which is how eventually we get a patriarch in Venice, because that's the title of the Aquilean bishop, which in 1450 becomes the title of the religious head in Venice.
And for Christians, I thought I'd ask, what not to miss in Aquileia? Well, Catherine told me the Basilica, the Mosaics of Jonah, the Whale, and of course the Paleo-Christian Museum.
The early Christian Museum is very interesting in Aquileia because it contains, they're mostly funerary inscriptions again, but they're incised with drawings as well. So you see figures, orons, praying with their hands up, which I'm informed by my Italian friends people still do here. Americans rarely pray with their hands raised in the air. There's a lot of scenes of baptism. So early Christian iconography, very interesting on these tombs because of the variety of scenes. Figures of the crucifixion, I think, if I remember correctly. And there's also a relief there that's supposed to be a depiction of Peter and Paul that's very early.
And my thanks there go to Professor Catherine McDonnell, who teaches Roman archaeology at the University of California, Los Angeles, with a particular expertise in the Roman Empire. Finally, moving on in the broadcast, on January the 18th, 2005, the Pave the Way Foundation was granted a special audience with the now blessed John Paul II in the Vatican's Clementine Hall. On this occasion, some 160 Jewish leaders, rabbis, and cantors from throughout the United States, Europe, and Israel, the largest group gathering of Jewish leaders ever to meet with a sitting pope, took part in this audience in an effort to thank the Holy Father for all the work he did to reconcile the two faiths. The group was led by the president and founder of the Pave the Way Foundation, Gary Krupp. He shared memories of this emotional meeting, as well as information on the work of his foundation, whose mission it is to bring together men of goodwill. Just listen. So, Gary Krupp, you're the president and founder of the Pave the Way Foundation. As you yourself stated on January the 18th, 2005, when you were granted a special private audience with Pope John Paul II, your mission at Pave the Way is to bring together men of goodwill, no matter what their religious background, and to ruthlessly tear down any wall that stops this from happening. Does that correspond to how you feel?
Yes, absolutely, and certainly in theory, but we take a much more practical step in that we try to identify obstacles between religions and remove them. And we also initiate huge gestures between religions, which we've done between the Vatican and the State of Israel and many other countries, work with many other churches as well, the Greek Orthodox Church, and so on.
Let's get to the audience with John Paul II in the Vatican's Clementine Hall. The date was January the 18th, 2005. There was a large group of you. I read that there were some 160 Jewish leaders, rabbis and cantors from across the world, actually.
Around the world, yes. This was an idea that we had because we felt that, literally, the Roman Catholic Church, not just under the papacy of the Pope John Paul II, but has always made initiatives to other faiths and has returned objects, of religious objects and shrines, and has done wonderful things in reaching out and trying to reconcile relations with other faiths. And it occurred to me that I have never heard, because we're in Rome quite often, and we're involved quite a bit, but we have never heard anybody formally thank the Church or thank the Pope for these actions. And so we tried to get a wonderful audience. We felt that we wanted to have a Jewish audience, and I wrote a letter to then-Archbishop Migliori from the United Nations asking him to formally request an audience. And at that time, if you recall, it was January of 2005, the Holy Father was not well. He had told me privately, he said, I really doubt this is going to be approved. But then all of a sudden we heard through our friend Father Norbert Hoffman that, yes, indeed, the Holy Father has personally interceded to say he wanted this audience. And we were extremely excited. It was marvelous. It was a fantastic event. I read a speech to him, which is all available on our website. You can hear the speech I made to the Pope, and the Pope's very clear speech back to us. He spoke very well, and then insisted on meeting every single person in the room. It's actually 168 people, and gave gifts to every person in the room. It was such an emotional event and such a fantastic adventure. It actually changed the course of the lives of many of these participants who had never been to Rome, really, or had certainly never met a Pope. But this man was such a holy man that it actually impacted the lives of many of these rabbis. One in particular in Israel, Orthodox rabbi, actually was inspired to start in the Orthodox world a institute with Christian Jewish study. And this came after this audience. It was a fantastic thing. It's very hard to describe. And this it was very sad because this was actually the last major audience that John Paul II had. He got the flu about 11 days later, and then we all know the history of his death in April. So it was very, very sad in that regard, but it was very inspiring. And in fact, the most unusual thing is that we actually had three rabbis, an Orthodox, conservative, and Reform rabbi, to bless the Pope. That blessing, you could see that on the website as well, the video of that. It was just a very powerful, very, very powerful event, and the Pope was very emotionally moved by this.
So I'd like to invite people to go to your website. Can you give the address?
Yes, it's pavethewayfoundation.org or ptwf.org.
And then you go to education, is that right?
It's under education, and it's the first item. It's the Jewish thank you to Pope John Paul II. And to be with him on that day and to see his expression when he was blessed by these three popes. This is in Sala Clementina. This is the largest, and the Vatican told us that this was the largest private audience with a sitting pope in history. And they said, this is historic. I said, well, which is even more historic is that we were actually able to get a Reform, Orthodox, and Conservative rabbi in the same room to do the same thing, because we have such division in Judaism. But it was so, and they were doing it to say thank you for all he had done certainly for the Jewish people and for the state of Israel. It was a marvelous, marvelous event, and one of the highlights of my life. I'll never forget it as long as I live.
Now, I know that if one goes to the website, one finds out what the milestones in that you mention in this speech to the Pope are in terms of Pope John Paul and Christian-Jewish dialogue. But can you mention some of them to our listeners?
Yes, certainly. We, as I said, we don't really deal at all with interreligious dialogue. We deal in practical problems. For example, we've been involved since 2003 trying to help move the finalization of the fundamental agreements between Israel and the Holy See. We had some very, very wonderful gestures. We were able to initiate the first loan in history from the Vatican to the State of Israel, where they loaned the manuscripts of Maimonides and others to the Israel Museum. We also are responsible for identifying the sale and for identifying a donor for the Roman Catholic Church to acquire the Bodmer Papyrus, one of the most important Christian manuscripts in the world. And this was a huge event that we did in 2007. And this is a very good friend of ours who is the donor, and this is now for the first time in history in the possession of the Vatican Library. It's the Gospels of St. John and St. Luke, with the oldest version of the Lord's Prayer in existence, written in the year 175 A.D., and our friend Frank Hanna from Atlanta, Georgia, is the donor who made this possible, which is a huge, huge psychological and religious event for the Vatican and for us, and to be part of it was such a privilege and very providential, because you have to say that many of the things that we do, which are so many of which are controversial, but it's this is being dictated by God, because there's no real reason why many of these things should have succeeded, but they have, and it's put us into a very, very wonderful position of trust, and through that we have advanced many other projects. One of our, as I said, controversial projects is that we've been working for the last 6 years revealing on our website as many documents, video eyewitness testimonies, newspaper articles possible dealing with the papacy of Pope Pius XII. Now, this has remained and has been for the last 46 years a major obstacle, certainly between Jews and Catholics and between Catholics and Catholics.
My thanks there go to the president and founder of the Pave the Way Foundation, Gary Krupp. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Don't forget we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. Listening to the English program of Vatican Radio, Laudetur Jesus Christus.